Okay.
This is Alan Granger calling to order the Design Review Board meeting of May 21st. We have a quorum at the table at this time, and I would just like to ask, first of all, does anyone have any issues with anything being discussed at today's meeting that is on the agenda?
No issues.
I will very quickly move to the approval of the minutes. I read the minutes and I saw no reason not to approve the minutes. Does anyone else have any comments?
Yep.
I'll move to approve the minutes.
Jim always has a little something.
Oh, there's a clarification.
Okay.
not a big one. As far as our DRB recommendation for the dog place, it says back gate. Could we just say facing Miller Road instead?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So the front, it's on Miller Road.
Yeah, so that's, and the, you know, the little recommendation bullet points. Then you go down and you have the motion, and I say do the same thing to the back gate on Miller Road. Mm-hmm. Just add on Miller Road.
Okay. Did you hear? Yeah, the back, the front, but it's out there in the front.
It's on, off of Miller Road.
I agree.
Okay. So, are you able just to edit that by hand, and I'll sign it?
Sure.
Okay, so we had a
motion meeting.
And we need a second.
So, I second it.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
So, now we have... Okay.
Kelly Tayara.
You're a guest because you're not on the agenda. And we've been joined by our council lady.
I'll try not to cause too much trouble.
Esteemed.
I'm not making any promises, but I'll try.
So, Kelly, since we're now on the record, would you like to just explain why you joined the meeting today? We're going to try and start our, keep to our agenda.
Okay.
So if you could summarize quickly.
Sure. So I stopped in to talk to Alan specifically, and because the Planning Commission made the very unusual and heart-wrenching move to approve a project for which the Design Review Board had recommended non-approval. And
unanimously.
Yes. And there was quite a lot of discussion at the Planning Commission meeting, but the most important thing was that I wanted to make sure that the chair knew that I had thought that perhaps the Planning Commission had reached out to him, but they haven't. So, so I thought it was important that they know, that the Design Review Board know that.
The project
was the Madison Landing project. Mm-hmm. And the Planning Commission said that that one of the commissioners said, and I had summarized it in the staff report that went to the director this past week. He hasn't yet issued a decision, but in that, one of the planning commissioners expressed real heartache about this and said that it would be unfair to rely on a recommendation from the Design Review Board where the Design Review Board had not identified the specific design guidelines that the project didn't meet. Another planning commissioner added that that there had to be a better process. There has to be a way to get the Planning Commission, the Design Review Board, and the planners all together to be able to communicate things early to the applicant to get them to understand things that are more subjective. So I think things that everybody's been discussing of late.
So is it too late? The hearing examiner hasn't made his finding now, has he?
It is not a hearing examiner decision. It's a planning director decision.
Right. So has the planning director given it his approval yet?
Not yet.
So should we write to the planning director and say we really strongly recommend that this be...
We've already taken our action on it. I don't believe we need to take any further action. And in light of the criticism about communication, we met with this applicant multiple times. The applicant never listened to the design review board and never came back with any variations that addressed any of the concerns of the design review board. And at the last meeting, when the project was unanimously declined approval, it was clear that the applicant had no intention to respect what the design review board was recommending. We made recommendations.
Yeah. It alters my vision of how we work with the planning commission, where at one stage we had said, you know, we're very comfortable to make a recommendation to them and not seek to veto, have the power of veto on a project. And it seems that we need to reestablish that as a...
I think the issue that the Planning Commission is bringing up is the legal issue that has been mentioned to us in the past in previous planning department administrations, that the design review board cannot make a decision or recommendations unless they can back it up with design guidelines. Until we have what I would call current and, no, current's not the right word, until we have refined design guidelines for us to be able to adjudicate a project on, then we are not left with any criteria other than to be advising the applicants with our recommendations. And that can be called subjective, but it was subjective of the whole design review board. It was not an individual's subjectivity. So whether that is still called subjective, I mean, I think that's what needs to be communicated to Gary.
What was the project against the Wallace?
Madison Avenue.
No, it's not an HDDP. It's a 24-unit multifamily.
I remember the project.
And one of the things that, you know, that was discussed, and I don't know if you recall it, but they originally had something else hadn't been communicated to you. So this is Madison.
That's Dwayne.
And this is Dwayne. Okay. And originally the applicant was going to go in this way, and they had like two spurs or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you said you need more open space, things like that. That was the result of the first one. So he came back and he created this kind of community open space back here, reduced the number of cuts to two, the number of driveway things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When he came back at that point, so he was in Planning Commission explaining this, and he felt that he had addressed your comments, the design review board comments. So he explained that in the Planning Commission. Then City Council entered into a developer agreement, three or four developer agreements with this Dwayne Lane right-of-way vacation. And I think the Planning Commission and I had understood that that this would be explained to you. Todd said at the Planning Commission that he had explained what this was all about. So basically, in order for Wallace Cottages to avoid cutting through the Nakata neighborhood, City Council entered into a bunch of agreements to open up this right-of-way. In doing so, Todd lost 15 feet, or will dedicate 15 feet of this property. As part of that agreement, he doesn't have to go out to Duane Lane. He can, so he'll now, he's eliminated this access, and he'll come in with these guys and dead end here. This will have a spur. So,
Kelly, I hate to interrupt here, mm-hmm. but this is a problem with the city, because it was explained to us that he didn't want to come out Duane Lane,
right?
Because it would have a negative marketing impact on his future development.
Yes, he has an 8-lot subdivision back here, and he likes that exclusivity.
So whoever approved that agreement at the city with engineering, they made a mistake. That should not have been approved, because the better design was to bring a single lane out where Duane Lane is going to have an access connection coming out, and a marketing of a future development should not be influencing what is a better vehicular circulation on this site.
Right, and I think, you know, part of that is that there aren't regulations in place or standards in place that would require either of those things. So because this is a multi-family development, this is not a public road. And so there aren't design standards for that. There's no standard or regulation in place that would make someone or try to force someone. And I understand this is a good example of the term subjective, that, you know, arguably, but some people think that it's a valid viewpoint to go through here. They like exclusivity. They want it for that market, that financial value. That's an opinion. And there's another opinion that says this should provide connectivity, things like that. So that's the subjective part. That's hard.
I feel on this one that what really happened was a communications breakdown quite early on. And all we 86 this thing in our mind, because he never, with everything we recommended, we weren't looking for him to get rid of units or anything like that. We never mm-hmm. said.
There was one suggestion that he reduce.
Yeah, we did say to take two out. Mm-hmm.
At one point.
Okay. But in general, I would say that if it came to that, everybody here realizes that you have to have X units there for his expectations. But all of our suggestions were within, they weren't going against any guidelines. We were just enhancing things, and we make these decisions based on the community, not on the developer. That's the only people we really have to serve. So I don't understand. In a way, we were following design guidelines by trying to make them be implemented the best way. Now, if he wants to go back and say, you know, set back from the street, blah blah blah, landscape, we can quote those. Do you agree on
that? That was.
I mean, I think everything we did. Yeah, in a sense, it was based on design guidelines. We just didn't call them out. I think we could easily go back
and grab
yeah.
it.
The issue was this guy.
They decided not to do that. The Planning Commission decided
okay.
not to do that.
Well, I believe this fellow, if his heart had been in another place, would have just slightly adjusted his design to come out with the same thing and everything. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to be the ones to make that.
That's okay.
I hope that we can just kind of forward. Everybody can kind of get where we want to go.
Well, I think you need to have a serious discussion with Gary. You sat in our meetings with this developer. You know what the atmosphere was. I believe, have a sense of what all the concerns were of the design review board. And if that is not able to be communicated to the Planning Commission, and the Planning Commission chooses to approve something that we've unanimously not approved, or we don't get to approve it, not recommended, then it is, in Gary's court to listen to the Planning Commission and to review the concerns of the design review board, and he has to then make his decision.
Maybe somebody from our group should, if there's a project comes up like this that we don't recommend, then when it goes in front of the planning, then somebody from our group should explain why we didn't do it.
There is some discussion with the Planning Commission about bringing design review board, maybe that means a design review board member and a planning commission member attend a conceptual meeting. So there are discussions ongoing about that. So I don't
want
to hold
up. Yeah, thanks.
I'm so sorry to hold up your.
That's all right. Thank you.
Apologies for us having an agenda item slipped in.
That's all right.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm trying to capture. Sorry about what was said. And there are minutes from the motion only, so that makes it difficult. But and would you like me to send that, Ron?
Yes. Oh. So what are you doing? You're more bays or more hay? What is it this
time? More bays.
More bays.
Well, replacement bays.
All right, I'm going to pass around just a couple copies of site plans and to share.
Thank you. We have a share one.
Are these the letters that were on the
yes,
on the drive?
This we forget.
Can I just pull down the revisions?
So I have this one that's going to be up on the screen.
Yes.
Okay. That's
fine. Right. We don't have full size of all of the revisions at this point, or at least multiple copies. But
okay, we usually start with introductions. My name's Alan Granger, Chair of the Design Review Board.
I'm Joe Dunstan, Design Review Board.
Steve Perry, Design Review Board.
Devin Johnson, Johnson Squared Architecture.
Trey Benson, Johnson Squared Architecture.
Carlos Block, owner of AK.
Olivia Sontag, planner. All right.
Ron Peltier, City Council.
All right. So, the applicant is proposing to remove an existing storage building right along here, and just for context, this is Sunrise. And they're going to replace it, so this is the proposed, with another retail storage building, approximately the same size. It's about 100 square feet larger. So that's the proposal. So they've got some additional landscaping that they're doing that's required as part of the proposal, additional parking. And they are required to comply with the commercial and mixed-use design guidelines and also the Rolling Bay design guidelines. We've reviewed those checklists, and everything appears to have been met. So I'm going to pass it over to the applicant's architect to explain the design, some of the materials, and answer any questions you guys have about the proposal. And I have all of the drawings up here.
Yeah, it's me.
So do you have, can you pull up the pictures? I guess that's the first portion. And then scroll through. It looked like you had one of the barn that we're taking down. So this is the current view of where we're planning on building the building, where the fence is. And to the right, the smaller barn is the building that we're taking down. So then the idea was that it truly is a barn, that they have potted materials, pots, that type of thing inside. So it is more like a warehouse than a retail space. And so our concept was to make it look like an old loading dock on the street side on Sunrise Drive. So that was kind of the initial concept. The lower portion of the building is going to be brick on only two sides now. We had to go into some value engineering, so that side that you're currently looking at and that side. So the two main sides that you'd see from Sunrise in the parking area. Okay. That side is going to be a metal siding that's a terracotta color, and then on the back side as well, just for durability, cost savings, and that type of thing. We'd have lap siding up above that would match the existing store, if you want to go to the just to the north, which is that building. So that's going to be, and we're going to use similar awning details as what's there. Upstairs is storage, light storage for t-shirts, bulk materials, that type of thing. And that's kind of the general concept. You're going to clean up the parking area. Most of the customer entering and exiting would be out the west side of the building. So, you know, you're already in the store, per se, when you're walking around the landscape sales areas.
Is there existing greenhouses there?
So there's that. That's an existing building. So if we went back to that first image, on the right hand side, that lower one, not the blue roof, but the silver roof behind.
The silver one.
Yeah.
And so that would go away.
That would go away.
No, and the greenhouse stays.
The greenhouse is next to
the greenhouse. Oh, that one stays.
It steps out of the view.
This is the one over there too.
That's the one that's going away.
That's, yeah. Okay. So this.
I'm confused then.
This big one.
That stays. Yeah.
It's staying.
Yeah. Okay. I just thought there was a greenhouse there. I'm mistaken.
So this is staying, and then go back to the other one.
Okay.
The other building is designed to obstruct the
this guy. And so we're we're blocking the view.
We're trying to block the view of the hay building from the road.
So you have these kind of a dock look along
correct.
That Sunrise?
Yeah.
So will they ever, are those doors actually movable or are they fixed?
So right now they're fixed, but they're going to be designed structurally so that if things change,
which
they could become, could become real loading docks. It's all framed that way.
Yeah.
But if
it could become windows.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't. I don't think you can load. Have a loading dock there because of the width of the street and all that, right?
No.
Right.
Okay. That's true. It would never be a loading dock.
Okay. No.
All right.
It's just the visual appeal of it.
And so, if you do value engineering and the brick became an expensive item or whatever,
correct?
Why not go with the same material you're doing on the sides on the front too? You just don't think it's as attractive?
We think the brick is a better look.
Attractive.
Yeah.
So you're willing to have two different materials for that?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I don't understand why there's any brick on it.
That's my question.
It's why does any brick?
Yeah.
Why does any brick at all? I mean, the brick is like putting wallpaper, particularly the way that the masonry is changing at an outside corner.
Looks like
a facade treatment only.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to it being a brick base. I mean, I can understand if the whole base was brick, but just taking it off two sides and leaving sort of the...
And we will have a brick pilaster there, that change of materials, but I could see or understand your point.
So is that the brick that you guys are thinking? So it's is it like a mini brick, really? Is it a thin brick?
No, it's a real standard size brick.
Okay, it's just
but that's sample. Just a veneer sample. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there any, just out of curiosity, is there other brick on the site?
There is not.
Yeah. It's kind of part of the...
Yeah.
It's kind of one of the alluring things about those cluster buildings, you know, that...
Mm-hmm.
No frou-frou, but very, very cool. And,
Right.
Yeah.
It's supposed to resemble a 1920s warehouse out of Seattle.
Right.
It's sort of what it was designed
at. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the loading dock look.
It's great. Mm-hmm.
Without being able to help with the elevation change.
You good?
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Both
of you
do it.
Well, and part of it is that the grade on this side is about 3.5-4 feet
yeah.
different. So it was a nice way to kind of adjust.
So can I ask you a question? I mean, the loading dock motif is totally fake.
Correct.
It's decorative. I'm wondering if you considered, I know you've got roll-up doors on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you considered that you know, one or two of these doors might actually lift up and have a, you know, railing across it. There might be cross ventilation running through there. I would say that kind of motif of the loading dock is way more important than the brick facade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in terms of what you're trying to achieve with the character of it.
I would say too that if you're going to go brick for whatever reason, then you'd want to get a good trompe l'oeil artist and paint some old signage that's barely visible,
right?
Like, you know, you see in Port Townsend, because then it really would look a lot older.
Yeah,
and same with any exterior lighting. Because, I mean, this is just a... If you're going to build a movie set, you might as well do it all and make it really good.
Yeah.
You know? So, and with these buffers and stuff, I get some old ones and stick them
right
in there.
Right, some beat-up wood.
And you know, do the appropriate exterior lighting that is like on a loading dock, and then it looks like it. Because, you know, my old Hollywood movie days, if you did that, you'd do all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would look incredible.
Yeah.
And even if you... even if you do it in metal siding, you can still do some old signage. You look great.
So, with respect to the comment about the operable doors and mm-hmm. on the Sunrise side, there is a functional component to it, still being a warehouse.
Sorry, say it again.
With the functional component of a door or an operable addition to that Sunrise facade, Howard needs to stack pallets against the wall, and that's the primary function.
Okay. On the inside?
Yes. So those will be all 13 feet high on the inside of those walls.
So,
and those are our longest walls to work with on that facade.
Well, I have to say I'd be happy if the brick went away, but...
Me too.
So you're carrying color you have on the two buildings, the original and then the new one,
the
trim will be the same, that'll link them together.
Okay.
There's one there. See, those two look the trim colors similar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They got a classic look there.
Yeah, people can start shooting westerns there.
They can. Yeah.
Exactly. The loading dock of the bank.
Exactly.
It has to be built out of brick, though.
So, are you hard pressed for this parking? Are there any issues with parking? Is it conforming?
We'll have more parking.
Yeah,
we have more parking, and we're just trading out one building for the other, basically.
Okay.
I did notice on the field the other day, buying some plants, and sunny day, and both sides of the street were just with cars.
Right.
I assume that really only happens seasonally, mm-hmm. really. I mean,
mm-hmm. yeah.
So you're looking at the Christmas parking lot mentality. I mean, you wouldn't want that all year round, but that happens, what, just in the spring or in the fall?
Saturday and Sunday in the spring.
Saturday, Sunday, spring, yeah.
Okay. I paved the road on the other side.
You paved?
I paved it.
Oh, you paved it. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's too bad you couldn't... You don't have a deal with the church at all, right?
I do.
Oh. Well, it seems... That's... I love it. If people can park in the church lot...
They do.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Does it say that on any signs? I didn't know that.
No, there's no signs, but you can park there.
Yeah, okay.
We have an agreement with them for the last 25 years.
Okay. And I'll park there.
So you said from the front...
For Sunday morning.
Yeah.
So from the front of the building to the back is about a 3-foot drop?
3.5 feet.
3.5 feet,
yeah.
So... Have you figured out accessibility and then you walkways and all yet?
So we've got the handicap parking up in this area right here, and then a walkway that'll go directly
that way.
That. Yeah.
Okay, come in that way.
Yeah.
Are you thinking this could be used for something else in the future?
No.
Have you planned anything into it that could be easily transformed?
No. I mean, it's got 14-foot high ceilings in it, so I mean, that's the basic idea. There's a simple bathroom, it's going to be a wide open building. So if somebody wanted to do something differently, they could. But I
think Alan's suggestion to having roll ups, I mean, it would be a very great space.
Yeah. And we are framing where those doors are. We're going to frame them as openings so that if somebody wanted to change the use of the building, they could easily take out those doors and put in windows or other options.
Well, I think with regards to the masonry, if I could summarize what I have heard the design review board say, we understand that a lot of projects have value engineering occurring during the life of the project, but the design review board would never require that there be masonry on this building.
Correct. Okay.
And we would like to give you the freedom to consider removing the masonry from the building,
mm-hmm.
although we aren't going to tell you to remove the masonry from the building. But we certainly, in my sense, we think the building is handsome without the masonry, and just having the same base siding running on all four sides rather than having two and two. Does that summarize what you guys were?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very historic cluster. It's one of the most well-known buildings on the island, really.
Yeah.
So I think you should, you know, when you come back to this, you think about that as well as far as the siding of the material goes.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, as far as people walking throughout the complex, they could come in the parking like they do now. And
correct.
Come this way, come this way, they'd walk in right through here.
Correct.
And they'd be that's sort of essentially the same as it is
as
now.
It is currently,
right. And just come in that way. Okay.
You call out second level loading for the doors upstairs?
Right.
Is that just
so it's basically
nice?
Well, the idea is to take a forklift and lift up these with these operable gates and an operable door that would open up so that they could easily unload and load boxes.
This is what I was going to suggest was in some of the money that you're saving from taking the brick off. But a lot of warehouse buildings would have hoist and pulley above an upper floor door like that.
Yeah.
And that might not be something that is used as opposed to a forklift,
right?
But it would be
have
the character that you're talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's a great idea.
Are you kidding?
Did you say I'm not kidding?
Are you kidding? Poetic.
Someone wants to get here.
So I have a question. Is there any? How are you mechanically ventilating the building? Are you doing?
So there are two HVAC systems.
Are they on the roof?
So they'd be up on the roof.
Are they?
And then
are they below this parapet, or are they not shown?
So I'm sorry. So the condenser coils would actually be underneath the stairs on the southern.
Oh, okay.
Or I'm sorry, on the southern side.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're underneath there, and then the actual units are hung in the ceiling. So the air circulation.
Okay,
that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah. Okay.
So nothing's poking out above that parapet height.
No.
Okay.
No.
Really?
So we shouldn't have anything on there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think a plumbing vent is going to
be.
So
there we go. Right.
Right.
Hang on.
does the design review board have any comments or questions?
Yep. So would you be okay with metal siding in place of the brick? Or do you, or
no, 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 wood matching.
Wood to match the other?
I think the metal, don't you have metal,
no, the
metal
back side
siding
would be
down
metal.
At the bottom?
That's it. I'll go wood, three sides, get rid of the brick.
Yeah.
That's
fine
with me. Okay. I'll do back wood on the back side. I want steel. Okay.
Yeah.
So that I can replace the panels when the forklift hits it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
And then call it a day. That's fine with me.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. It's not that critical. It's not worth arguing about.
Well, we weren't trying to argue.
No, I not argue or even, you know, I just thought brick would look better. So.
Okay. Could I hear a motion? You're actually seeking approval.
Yes.
Or
okay.
A recommendation.
Do you have any conditions?
No.
I move that we approve this project and send it on.
I second.
May I suggest we add a comment that if the applicant removes masonry and substitutes it with a different material, that is in the context of our approval.
Yeah, so that is a recommendation. So I move that we approve this project with the one recommendation of having the applicant look at the siding and go with the wood. Over some of the
checks.
I think we're fine.
Okay. And that was seconded previously.
Yep.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the nice presentation.
Okay,
makes it really easy.
Just out of curiosity, where is this existing garbage map? What you
it's right there.
Right there.
Yeah.
So they just back in? So what they do?
They back in.
They just back in.
Are there any plans to do anything on that parking lot that you know of?
On my parking lot?
Sure.
Any plans?
Yeah, have you ever heard any talk about anything happening with that area?
No. They just striped it.
Yeah. I wish you'd take it over.
I tried. That's
what I meant.
No, I tried to buy another lot.
Oh,
and then it's
going
to be a lot more. I wanted to see the corner of his commercial.
Yeah.
So it's a waste of commercial space.
It's very much a waste. And it would dense that whole thing up.
So there were two lots down below, and I tried to get them to, I would buy those.
Yeah.
Swap them. But they were, I don't know, $650,000 or something like that for a lot. Okay. So it just didn't work out. But it would be nice.
It might happen someday, right?
Yeah.
You're still a young man.
That's true.
Olivia, would you please let Christy know the direction?
Yes.
Thank you.
See you. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much.
Good to see you.
Yep.
Thanks
very
much. Thank you.
I don't know that this will be an issue now that we're kind of ahead of schedule, but we have, there's another meeting happening in this room right after 5, so.
We intend to be finished.
We
don't have a quorum after 4:30, so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We're planning on being done by 4:15.
We are?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to.
Sounds good. I
can
go to the gym and work out.
I thought you were loosing your back in your.
On the sidewoods?
Yeah, no, the whole.
Oh, well, no, I have a schedule, so.
Well, you know, if they go down for a little bit of
business.
It's great.
To be perfectly honest with the discussion earlier, I think it actually represents one of the downfalls of the planning development not writing inadequate report substantiating the movement of a project from application through the design review and going on to the planning commission, because that would have clarified a lot of the questions in my mind.
Yeah, because we're going to waste our time.
Well, yeah,
because you approve the ones that are good, And it, you ignore it on the ones that are bad and need help. It's just a complete waste of our time.
So Kim came to me. Kim, I don't know which
developer. Why volunteer?
Kim from the Planning Commission.
Kim from the Planning Commission came to me and said that all the planning, her feeling with all the planning department had done was just move to a common forum with nothing else.
No, well, that's not their role there,
right. And so I said, well, here it is. And I sent her some information that came from the notes, you know, and I thought that would help. Well, now, I think she's a lawyer. She wants it.
I understand it on one hand.
Yeah.
But I think this is something that's been discussed about working together with the planning group and, you know, both planning, the planning commission. Go ahead.
I think the thing that is missing here is that the planning staff does not come to us with a recommendation of here is this project that you're going to be reviewing. This is what we think about it.
Right.
And here's our recommendation of what the design you ought to focus on.
Right.
It just lines on the table.
But I don't think that's their question. For instance, when Heather would present something, she would let us know what things we might find objectionable and probably that they did as well. But I don't think they feel that they should direct it in any way.
Okay, but if you review some of the documents that have been going around with regards to review changes.
Yeah.
And review the Seattle design.
Right.
Guidelines.
Yeah.
And the early design guidance meeting.
Yeah.
They talk specifically about the planning staff making their presentation of what of what they think is up or down about the project. Or things of concern about the project. The planning department can't sit on the fence in bringing things to us and then taking things to the planning commission.
No, I mean, I feel they definitely have a responsibility to call out where there are issues with the code and things like that. But if we meet with people early on and we tell the planning commission what the reasons we do things when it comes up. It's not going to happen. Nobody's going to go there for the Bay A. It's only every now and then we have these kind of projects. I don't know. I see some merit into some comments, why we made comments. I think all our comments were based on guidelines, frankly. I mean, our interpretation of the guidelines, but it wasn't written down.
It came off too conversational, maybe.
Yeah, but I think everything we talked about was based on the guidelines and principles.
And to be honest, it was never clear to me that a deal had been cut.
Oh, the road?
On the road.
Yeah. That was late in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I agree. And that was one of our big issues, because that bit of landscape was what we were hoping
absolutely
to preserve. I mean, it's
great,
old particular, place. Unique landscape.
Well, and also the fact that we were trying to get him back off the road so that there's
back off
the road.
Less paving.
Because, you know, frankly, I don't know why bother as a result of this. Why bother?
Well,
this is one I've cared about more than any other.
I'm about to encourage you to step up to the plate so that you reapply. Because the last thing that I had heard was that you hadn't reapplied for your seat.
I did.
Oh, you did. Thank you.
Yeah.
But as soon as you said, why bother?
Yeah, but I mean, now I sort of feel like, why bother?
Oh, come on, Peter.
No, I really do. What's the point? Because those are the kinds of projects that we care about. That and
the ones that we say.
Well, they have way more impact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope there's an interview.
Pardon?
Is there an interview for you?
There is one. With me and Ron.
Then my reapplication will be conditional. It will. Screw it. You know.
Excuse people me. People listen to you.
Well.
I will go with it.
You know, I don't want to do this anymore if it's a waste of time.
Well, no.
It's boring.
I don't think any of us want to waste our time.
No.
No.
Is this it today?
This is it.
Yeah.
We have a call.
This is how it is.
And it ends at,
really?
It ends at 4:30 because
really
he has to leave.
Yep.
So we have
Kristen,
no
quorum.
Kristen, you have the devoted design of your board members.
Yes.
Yeah. well,
yeah,
I know
more?
You're all devoted.
No, thank you.
I have a lot of you. And unfortunately, Charlie and Jonathan, I told them 3:10.
That's fine.
So we have a little time to fill.
Oh, good.
But we only have, just so you know, we only have until 4:15.
4:15. That's fine.
Because we lose our quorum.
Can you drink that?
Yeah.
Actually, I'll go at 4:30.
You have to go.
We don't need a quorum to discuss things.
We
unless you
need
guys
a,
have a policy.
We do need a quorum.
Oh, really?
We've been told in the past that we cannot meet at all in this room
without a
quorum. Because I've asked in the past, if we don't have a quorum, can we still meet to talk about things? And the answer has been no.
Okay.
So I'm going by that previous rule. So you
right.
Start.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry Jason's not here because I know he's had a lot of interest in this. But I was talking with Jennifer last week, and I wanted to check in with you face-to-face because I haven't been a part of the conversations about the mandatory green building standards. And Jason mentioned last time we met that he thought that that was something that could be done by July 9th. And I know there's a lot on everybody's plate, but I haven't been part of those conversations. I know our building official came and gave you guys a briefing of some sort, but I'm not really sure where that was left. And we were remembering that green building is on the wall, so it's a priority of the council. And I actually just don't know enough to know how difficult it is to implement a mandatory green building requirement. And I would think that the design review board would have a lot to say about it, and could go through a process where you would review the pros and cons of doing that one, and then the pros and cons of the various certifications.
The only person I feel that's,
mm-hmm.
that would be
cool.
excited about that and
mm-hmm.
would be Jason,
mm-hmm.
and he's definitely very up to speed on it, as
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I would say that is myself.
Okay,
do you agree?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
With you.
Absolutely. And to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever could be put in place will not be redesigning the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
It will
right,
be
right.
looking
we're
towards
yeah.
another
yeah.
jurisdiction's
right.
standards, which could be adopted, even if they're adopted on an interim level. Green building standards could be adopted just the same way as cities adopt the state building code.
Right. Well, and that's why I thought it wasn't that difficult of a thing to accomplish. It was just choosing the one,
just
or giving council a set of options from which to choose the one, or
that's right.
maybe there's several.
Because Gary had
choose.
A whole series of
right.
books saying these are the different
yeah.
guidelines.
Yeah.
But where does smart growth fit into that?
Well,
not into the building codes, right?
No.
No. Okay.
No, so he is such an ideal person for this.
Yeah.
And I would say, as far as the DRB is concerned, that you would just work directly with Jason.
Because we would defer to him anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So could you maybe see if you can schedule him for a separate meeting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I just wanted to get up to speed on what you guys have done and in terms of it seems a reasonable place from which to get a recommendation for council.
Yeah.
For staff to bring forward.
And is Living Building Challenge, was that in the comp plan? Were those words in there?
I don't think
I
so.
I seem to remember that they're already somewhere.
Something about green building.
Green
building.
But not living building.
Not a specific standard.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just one option. And
And my sense is that that's where we got to. We just got hung up on choosing making it so.
I agree.
But it just doesn't seem that hard to controversial.
I mean, my recommendation would be that in introducing something,
mm-hmm.
we don't set the bar up here, which would be the Living Building Challenge.
Right.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
We introduce interim green building
mm-hmm.
Requirements for the more middle of
the world. Maybe you should have two people in the room when you're talking to them.
Well,
that's a very good point. No, I agree.
I just think it's very dangerous to come out with new ideas
mm-hmm.
that are beyond gold-plated, they're platinum-plated.
Beyond platinum.
Well, and I mean, I think even if you guys don't all have the expertise or high level of interest, I think a group setting is a good idea because you guys know the language. At least,
mm-hmm.
like you can talk about it and you can have those sorts of conversations.
I think we're all very interested.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just he's the one that does it every day.
He's
and
an expertise.
He's an expert at it.
Yeah,
that was all.
Okay.
We're all interested.
All
right. We're all supportive.
I would totally back Alan's comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Don't want to go all out.
Yeah, the goal isn't to have riots in the streets.
Depends on who you ask, I guess. So today we're going to talk about where Jonathan and Charlie are going to be back to talk more about their how far they've gotten in terms of subdivision standards. And are you the only one that's been participating in the small group? You and Jason?
Oh, Jason.
Okay,
yeah.
So then it'll be new for you three to take a look. And I guess I'll just give this out so you can look at it. At least you can take a look at it before
you
get there.
So did you generate this personally?
No, I did not.
Who did?
Jonathan and Charlie.
Okay.
And here's another version of this you've seen before.
Yeah.
John has seen before.
I'll be interested in what comments can.
So my understanding is that this has been updated since last Thursday. Their presentation will be just work to date. And just to give you guys an introduction to this is we had two small work group meetings, which was a combination of some folks. And this is basically the outcome of that, where they framed the problem, if you will, and then developed a set of principles, and then the principles went into developing this revised table of dimensional standards for subdivisions. And
so Davis and Renslow was also at the meeting?
They're the ones, the city.
They're
the consultant,
right. So they've been leading
the
effort.
So they were at the
meeting.
They
were leading the meetings.
Okay.
So if you guys aren't familiar with 1812 of our zoning code, it has these dimensional standards for all of the zoning designations. So this, what they're presenting here is a revision to that table. And we haven't gotten to any revisions to 1712, which are where the actual subdivision standards are. But essentially, I think I'm repeating myself, but it's basically taking these principles and then putting them into three dimensions or two dimensions, really.
Can I had a question about this.
Mm-hmm.
Under the home site
line,
and it says maximum home size
mm-hmm.
site square feet.
Mm-hmm.
Does that limit the size of a house that you can put on a site? Are there any things like building footprints, FARs, anything else that would determine that?
No.
So are you saying that they're saying that the largest house you can build on an R4 or 0.4 site is 10,000 square feet?
In a subdivision, right? So we're only talking about subdivision
standards. We're not talking about...
What if you have a 2.5 acre site?
This doesn't apply. So there's two tables in section 1812. One is for everything. Yeah. One is for subdivisions, okay. And one is for everything else.
All right.
So this only applies in subdivisions.
But I will ask you, just theoretically, if you have a site that conforms to the R.4, why should, and even if it's within a subdivision, let's say it's seven of them, why should the house be limited? Why should there be difference on that piece of land than there would be if it was just a regular piece of land? Well, that's sort of, in other words, if it's just one house, why is that's not limited in square footage? Why is the one that's the same size land being limited? Just because people, am I making any sense?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I guess I'm looking at it slightly differently. I'm looking at it from a point of view of, let's just take our one, for instance.
Yeah.
A 4,000 square foot house on one floor.
So this is the home site, not the home footprint. So theoretically,
what's the difference between the
two? A home site is basically what's currently, it's your building envelope, essentially.
That's the footprint.
Not necessarily. It's the developed area of a lot. So they're not talking about lot size, they're talking about home site. So in the cluster subdivision, you don't have lot size minimums, you have home site minimums. So it's different.
So could it be 8,000, you have two stories you can have, essentially?
Yeah.
So it'd be an 8,000 square foot house? Mm-hmm.
So I think that you guys are going to the extreme, because the home site is where all of the developed, that's your driveway, that's your landscaping, it's your developed area of a lot. So it's, typically, and in cluster subdivision, well, this is exactly it, Charlie drew it last time. So here's your, this is your lot.
Yeah.
And then this is your home site within the lot.
Right, and where's the home within the home?
The home's in here. And what you're saying is that, you could do, you can make your home the whole size of it to get to your 4,000 or 10,000 square feet, but it's because the home site has a lot more than just your house, you're not going to max out your home site with your house.
But it still limits how many square feet you can have in the house.
Well, ultimately, yes.
So who established where those home sites are? What establishes? The setback to the street.
Other dimensional standards. Mm-hmm.
So that was what I was trying to get at in my thing that I wrote to you guys.
Yeah.
You know, that in the 10,000, 12,000, even 15,000 square foot lots, you're going to end up every time with Asbury Court. There's just no way not to do that, because it's going to be the same setback. So all the homes are going to be the same setback, going down the same line. You have no ability to vary the road, vary the frontage, move one back, move one forward. And I think we're building in, if we allow that kind of thinking, that kind of system, in those kinds of lots, I think we build in crappy neighborhoods. We've actually enforced it, in my opinion.
So
you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah. So the idea is that you're on a transect here.
Transect.
Like the smart growth transect between rural and urban, So these dimensional standards are supposed to acknowledge that you want flexible standards. You want different standards in different parts of the island. So whether or not that they've landed there yet, I don't know.
Okay.
And I also don't know what their thinking is on those other dimensional standards, because that would obviously be important.
But what I'm saying is, on R2, I think R2.9, personally, all the way to R14, should not have any subdivisions allowed at all. That's my opinion. Subdivisions should not be allowed. The subdivision concept I mean, because if even in R2, if you have a 15,000 square foot lot, mm-hmm. okay, and you like those Asbury Court, for example, are they're about 10,000 square feet. I'm not quite sure what they are.
They're much smaller than that.
Smaller than that. Uh-huh. They build a 4,000 square foot house. Mm-hmm. They're maxing up against mm-hmm. their front setback, their side setback.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
So all the homes are going to have the same setbacks.
Mm-hmm. To max it out.
To max it out. Mm-hmm. So we just regulated Asbury Court. Mm-hmm. We just allowed it to happen. In fact, we encouraged it to happen, in my view.
Right.
Whereas if we just said no such thing as a subdivision in that zone, that they're required to do, clustered or some other system. Unless I'm missing something, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm just looking at me like I'm.
No, I understand what you're saying. And I quoted your email to these guys, so we can bring that up in terms of the context of their thinking.
Yeah. Before we leave this, I'm just going to go back to the R1 because the math is easy. So we have the 40,000 square foot parcel. Which is basically the acre, and we're accounting for 60% of that. What's the other 40%?
Yes, we can answer that.
Yeah, it's,
it's just not
put into one of these boxes.
I guess you guys have. We were expected to start for 3
days.
She couldn't wait.
I gave her a chance to read it before
you. It will all be explained.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And to give them a chance to get hooked up here, maybe you guys can, for those of you who haven't seen these guys before or looked at this, if you want to just take a chance to read this quickly so that it grounds you a little bit mm-hmm. in the thinking that went into this table. There we go.
I know this is.
You're an expert. Yes. So thank you guys for coming. And actually, we've got 3 DRB members here who haven't been to the small work groups, so that's some information. And then we've got one who was but isn't here, and then we've got Jim, who's the diehard.
Who wasn't there, but might not be here.
Keeps coming back. Yeah.
But everyone did see the presentation I gave about a month and a half ago to you guys.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which was an introduction to it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Right.
And by the way, we have till 4:15.
So I guess we'll just jump into it a little bit.
Do you want to give us a bit more time to read this?
Feel free if you want to read. So, just a little bit of background. I mean, obviously, this is a very condensed process we're going through. So, we're trying to move forward, and you'll see in the information we're bringing today, we're actually looking now at design guidelines and revised dimensional standards. So, we're trying to sort of, we started with more of the conceptual piece in the beginning, kind of a problem assessment. And now we're trying to go to the opposite end to sort of look at outcomes, see how well they speak to each other with your guys' input. One of the fundamentals in the old subdivision code, let's call it our existing subdivision code, as you guys know, you have 2 pathways, at least you used to. You had open space and cluster. Mm-hmm. Cluster is what resulted in more ways than one at Asbury Court. And now you're no longer allowed to do cluster development. That's, I think, the council voted to eliminate
the smaller.
In the higher density zones.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about those 2 pathways is one was focused on open space, the other was focused on cluster development. You'll see that fundamentally, this new approach is saying both are important and both facilitate each other. That we need to cluster to create open space. And now we're thinking about new ways
to define open space, to think about aspects of community as well as the natural functions of a site. Mm-hmm. So a little bit more expansive definition, perhaps. And also, I think as Jonathan has put forward really nicely in these presentations, is just the notion of community. And as you think about a concept like a cottage community, I'll just use that as an example, there are all sorts of patterns that are prescriptive to getting a cottage community approved. And one of the fundamentals is thinking about site design in a way that nurtures community versus just houses along a road going off into the woods. So you're going to find some of that thinking embedded in this new approach.
Yes. And we looked at, I mean, Charlie says that we talk about design standards in here. What we started looking at was principles. And what were the principles that were important to making these communities? And as we talked about it, it was like, so how's the DRB going to, how's the Planning Commission going to judge this, rate this, you know, be able to provide some input? And we felt that, yes, principles are great, but we needed something more like the design guidelines to be able to have some, a bit more definition. I think it'll make your life easier in the long run. And so what we then started to do is how do we, in sort of open space subdivisions, are sort of the open space is usually wetlands or some sort of critical area, and it's anything but open. It's wooded, it's not accessible a lot of the time. Whereas, so we started to say, okay, well, we have these critical area requirements, but let's call them those pieces falling into this idea of natural space or natural environment that is a place for preservation, conservation, protection. But then those spaces are often not great spaces for enabling community. You don't sort of necessarily bump into your neighbor in the woods kind of thing. Yeah. So then we created the idea of community space, which is more of a, is it a passive or active space where events could happen, whether it's food production or gathering or play or whatever that may be. Or maybe it's just a beautiful manicured garden, if that's what a community wanted. And so that kind of became the natural, we saw that as the natural environment principles. How do we maintain those pieces? And then what are the principles that have to shape the built environment? And those actually become more extensive because I think there's more flexibility or more options within those. And so we then broke it out into natural and built principles, and now we've got natural and built guidelines.
One other thing as well that I think we're also trying to anticipate a better process for review, which clearly is driven by your desires as well. And what's built into this methodology is that the principles are brought forward at the conceptual design meeting and reinforced again at the pre-application conference. And the idea would be is that the applicants are required to respond, and you can ask them for a response to the key principles. And that is kind of a building block to get their story engaged with the outcomes we're looking for. And then as they get deeper into the process, and again, this may become apparent at the pre-app stage, is yes, there will be new design guidelines that reinforce almost hand-in-hand those principles, but become more specific about the way the guidelines do now. They're more prescriptive about, you know, let's just say for Erickson that you'll have pitched roofs. It isn't just about neighborhood character. Now it's about, here's what we're expecting.
Right. Right.
So with those two things, our hope is as you engage people in the more thoughtful, deliberative process in parallel with you at the concept level,
and then pre-app.
Yeah. And then obviously we need guidelines. We think everybody wants guidelines, and today we'll be showing you a list of 20 guidelines that if you think back to Christopher Alexander and sort of his pattern language, I mean, these are really patterns that we're trying to enable good site planning outcomes.
Sounds good.
So we've been developing these principles, but then we have been looking at the design standards, and that's kind of another discussion that we want to have with you. But maybe we go through the principles. They will sort of guide the guidelines. Excuse me. They will hint at some of the dimensional standards that we will come to, and just talk through those principles. We've got kind of a main list of principles, a guideline, excuse me, and then there's a secondary list that these additional guidelines that could become in the primary list, or they could be incentivized guidelines. That they may be too much to ask for every community, but they're something that can be out there. Someone comes and goes above and beyond, they get some sort of benefit from it. And there's all sorts of ways people could benefit from it.
So just to give you a quick preview of what this outline represents, and sorry there's no page numbers, but you'll see where design guidelines are listed, A, B, C, D.
Mm-hmm.
If you flip to the next page, which is the back page, you'll then see some of the fundamentals of the development standards and dimensional standards. And then you're going to see something called incentives. You may recommend that these are not incentives, they're requirements. We just weren't sure how deep to go. And then lastly, we have something called other considerations. This does not mean they're the least important, but they're just factors that we need input on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe before we start with the design guidelines, do you mind if we just walk you through a couple of high-level things on the development standards? Because I think they show you how there's an opportunity here to fundamentally rethink some really basic things about subdivisions. Two of them, Jonathan already talked about, the idea that natural space and community space are both requirements as a percentage allocation.
Yep.
We're not sure what those numbers are yet, but we're trying to figure it out. Parking can be located outside of an individual lot. Currently, you're not allowed to do that in a subdivision. HDDP allows it, but that's more the in-town urban subdivisions. You go outside, you have to drive up and park on your lot.
Right.
Okay. We're saying we think that should be changed. And we'll talk more about these later, but also that the lots can be separate from a right-of-way or access, that you, again, you could have a home that you have to walk to from the road. Currently, you're not allowed to do that.
Except in HDDP again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, HDDP kind of bundles the flexibility we get in the mixed-use town center with planning on top of that.
So I can't drive into my living room anymore? Something.
You might have to be seen by a neighbor now, unfortunately.
Yeah,
right. This is the risk we're taking as a community.
That's right.
But I guess if someone wanted to design a community that allowed you to do that, we don't want to stop that.
Yeah,
we want the flexibility to be able to do so.
Right, sure.
Not necessarily precluding everything that you can do now, but
sure,
allowing some creativity in how you approach the design of a community.
And then just one other one, and then we'll come back to these and talk about them again once we're done, but that there may not be any need for maximum lot coverage anymore, that we may have other tools that are more appropriate and controllable, like maximum home site, and just we don't even care what the lot structure is in the end. And the fundamental idea here is that I think we want to come up with a process where you come up with the best site plan and then shape lots to support it and make it be a subdivision, rather than, I'm oversimplifying, but to say you carve it up first and kind of create your site design out of the pie, you know, the puzzle pieces.
Right.
So it's sort of inverting the usual logic that I think some people use.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be tough for the development process, for a developer?
No.
As far as laying things out, selling things?
When you see HDDPs, they're all done that way. We're used to doing, I mean, we don't think about lots until somebody forces us to make it work. I mean, we're much, you know, most people want to think about the design, but when you get out of town folks, and Jonathan's talked about this multiple times, they want a lot that they can park this house in because they've done it a million times.
Right.
Yeah, lot is commodity.
Yes.
Standard so subdivision.
I hate to jump right into the weeds.
Yeah.
On the development and dimensional standards, one of the issues that has always been about the definition of a lot has been that that lot is accessible to emergency vehicles and emergency services. So, you know, you have the question of how the aid car gets to the house to save the person who's needing medical attention is one of the key issues about the identification of a lot, an address, and you know, dark winter's night, no streetlights, you know. How do you get there? And so there's some other things about being separated from a public right-of-way or private access lanes. The notion that vehicles may be parked separately, which suggests that is that the location as that's the furthest the emergency vehicle can get. I mean, so just from the practicality point of view, whether it's fighting a fire or delivering the ambulance.
So we are consulting with the fire marshal as we go down this path to make sure we're, because we can't not meet those rules.
And they, in fact, don't have a particular rule that says they have to be able to park right at the front door of any unit. They want to be a certain distance from it, or they want to have a certain type of pod to get to it. Just like they might if they had someone in an apartment building on the third floor, unit 10, they know there's a path to it, but they don't necessarily get their vehicle there. So there is some flexibility within their requirements as to how far they need to be and if what is the connection from A to B that their staff or their know how to get there.
The emergency provider.
Yeah. So there are regular, like these red circles show that's 150 feet from where the fire department can park their vehicle. They want to be able to be at least 150 feet from a house. From the fire department's point of view, if you go further, you sprinkle. But from the emergency medical providers, they want to know that they don't necessarily have a distance, but they want to know that they have several points of access on a good path to get there.
So that would require then that you have a wide pathway that's solidly surfaced so that they can run again.
Right. So
I wonder if that second story of a building that's on fire, you know, do they have to run with ladders or can a ladder truck reach it? Because that's kind of
I think a simple way to think about this is think about the relative density and flexibility we have in the mixed-use town center right now.
Yeah.
It accommodates all these things you're talking about. So whatever we're comfortable with now, we're not supposing anything more complex. In fact, it's probably less.
Yeah, probably a lot less, I think. Mm.
But they do have portable ladders they do carry.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a question.
So does it make, and we want this to be what's the best way to go through this for the DRB, does it make sense to just talk about the design, potential design guidelines and see if these begin to attack issues that you've seen that we want to shape and control?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess I have one question, and I don't want to get in the weeds, but on number six, no maximum lot coverage, will be controlled by maximum home site area. How do you see that maximum home site area being defined?
So I think what the factors that would go into a home site.
That's what we're getting in on. When you guys came in, we were discussing. Is this just a typo of a difference between these two?
No, this is the...
This says home, capital H, capital S, site. Yeah. This says home site.
It's the same thing.
Okay.
And which would you prefer it go by?
What's already in code under flashlight, Charles? Do you know what the term is? Is it?
It's home site. One word.
One word. We should keep it consistent
because we. Well, we start. It was in this chart as lot size, and we got away from the idea of lot. Mm-hmm. We talked about home size, and so that's just how the formatting was set up.
Okay.
But a home site is something where the house is built. It may not be the lot, but it's lot, maybe a lot of lots surrounding that area that is not part of the home site. Well, that home site sits within a greater lot.
So I'm getting to the weeds. So I don't mean...
No,
that's
good.
Because we started out, and they said someone had already drawn that thing. I have a little heartburn when I think of that the home sites are being, the home site areas are being defined by that 25-foot max by setbacks. And the setbacks are related to lots. So if we get rid of lots, I want to get rid of setbacks.
Well, that's so that
drawing up there is not what you're talking about.
Let me explain the intent there. And okay. This is just a reiteration of what's in current code.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Home site... It's about clustering, and the idea was there's a maximum separation of home sites to legitimately be clustering. If you make home sites 200 feet apart, you're not clustering. So that's the idea in current code of the 25 feet. Home site is meant to encapsulate the home, let's say the garage, the driveway, the patio, let's even say the private garden, where there's kind of a level of disturbance.
Yeah.
That's the basic idea.
Okay. Alright.
And we haven't got into it in this chart. Okay. We have thought about in the different densities, in the different zones, that maximum spacing may change. If we even need to define it.
Right.
I think in a lot of cases where the home sites may all be adjacent to each other without any separation.
Right.
But at some point, you don't want to let it get bigger than a certain amount. Otherwise, it starts to spreading out over the site more, and potentially making more disturbance.
I'm wondering why, point four. Why a home site needs to be 10,000 square feet?
Can we come back to that? That's a great question. We're not sure that's right either.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think the fundamental, Alan, and the group is. Is the concept of home sites the right planning tool versus lot size, maximum lot coverage? I mean, we're really kind of breaking out of the box here a little bit, and we got to make sure we're doing it in a way that's going to yield good results and not unintended consequences.
So what I'm hearing, just to make a comparison analogy, is that with the SAR, or we used to be called SAD, I guess it used to be called SAD, or whatever. The idea was that an architect could come in, take 5 acres, find the best place for a building, and build a building, and then put everything else in wherever they go. Now, what you're saying, which I actually like, is no, there's a natural open space, there's a community space, and those things are defined possibly beforehand, or at least in conjunction with a home site.
Yes.
So there isn't a preference to the home site being to. Taking, like, say, engineers will always take surface water drainage and just, it's a negative thing, and put it in the corner. So that you were talking about, and maybe we don't want to do that.
Right.
We might want to find a good place for that. So the home site it ends up not actually being the best place, necessarily. So I like that concept.
If you take a site... And you evaluate it and say, okay, we've got a great cluster of trees here, and there's some steep slope here,
And this is actually a great place to do dispersion here. You know, we're left with that. That's your home site. If you're looking at one site, now you take that over the subdivision and you do that and find out where all these things are, and then you put the houses in the sort of leftover space.
What's left up?
In a certain way.
Right. Yeah.
So that, I mean, it's not, you look at it in a much more balanced way than that.
Yes.
But that's the idea that's what we're seeing.
And this concept's been around, how long, Alan, since anybody else? Ian McCarg. This is
standard.
Like,
yeah.
If we look at this, this is the Ashbury site, which we looked at before, and it's got.
It's inspiring.
It's got 5% natural area in the trees. It's got no community space. Its lots take up 66% of it, and the infrastructure is about 29% of it. But if you remember this drawing that I did, if you took where the trees used to be and said those trees are they're the natural space, we've got to save those. You get this number of houses and this much access, and we want the houses facing on the community space. The access has to be reasonably balanced so you can have a short walk, or maybe it's a loop road that has access to garages on it. You then come up with something that's a much more balanced kind of process. And that site has 34% natural area, 20% community space, 28% of it's in the... This is an older drawing. Is in the lots, but these would be home sites now. The lots could encompass more, and then there's only 18% in infrastructure. So every site's going to have to be as we do in design anyway. The engineers come in and roll out a plat. They don't think about any of it. They just figure out how to get lot commodities and access to them, and follow the 50-foot right of way principle.
And one of the things, real quickly, I just want to interject is we're also on the separate track talking about land use review procedures, and it could be that one of the things that we're missing that could be a component of the early touch or early design guidance meeting conversation is an actual site assessment, going back to the the McCargian approach of what's a site? What's the site telling us? What's the good, the bad, the opportunity? Which I don't think we have at all, certainly not for subdivisions, and I think even in our pre-app for DRB, they're already beyond that site assessment level.
But the SAR that's in place should, in my mind, is sort of one of the first things we do as a designer. You look at the site, and then if we come to DRB at a pre-app. We would bring the SAR thinking in. We would then say, here's how we're thinking about the subdivision. This is how we're meeting those principles. Here's our community space. Here's our natural space. This is how we've reduced the impact of cars. You guys would say, great. Or I might say, well, I'm just going to do a standard cul-de-sac approach. And you go, you haven't done that yet. You haven't reduced the impact of the car.
The site assessment review can be process of defining the problems that have to be solved.
Yeah.
The opportunities and challenges and so on. Rather than a laying down of the law the way engineers like to do it.
And I think that's the engineer is an important part because that's who's reviewing the SAR right now.
Yeah, an engineer.
Right.
So there's other things I think that the site assessment obviously has to take into account. So how we can, one, use an existing process so we don't create a new one, but two, make sure the right eyes are on it at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be really valuable to the end product.
So this process you're talking about, I see, really works really well in the R.4, R1, R2, possibly R2.9, but as you get more and more dense, have you worked this out? Do you still think it applies?
I do. We're playing with ideas, and I have drawings and things, but I don't have them here today, but we've been looking at the impact. And I mean, this table is evolving. It changes almost every day with the percentages and everything based on feedback or what we are exploring. But I think you can take these principles to every zoning and get some natural space and get community space and reduce the impact of vehicles and still create communities. And
And if you start to get into subdivisions that have multifamily housing in it, you start to open up the site too. So there is potential, I think, to make it work across the board.
Does community space really apply to the larger size lots?
I think it can. If you're just doing a two house, you know, taking 5 acres and splitting it in two, maybe not. But maybe it's a way to, so you don't have to duplicate everything. Instead of having everyone each having two lawns, you have one lawn that's a shared lawn. It's the same sort of idea as shared driveway. Mm-hmm. Instead of two driveways in, have a single driveway.
I think the other thing too that's probably in the back of everyone's minds is we're not trying to social engineer subdivisions. Not everybody wants to have a community space in the middle of their neighborhoods, and I think part of the metric that Jonathan and I have discovered is as you're more urban, the community space should grow as a feature and factor in the community. Mm-hmm. And take on a more prominent location. I think as you get more and more rural, its importance diminishes, but maybe other factors take over as more significant, certainly the ARPA, you know. But it doesn't mean it necessarily disappears completely. And it's kind of a function of a family having their private backyard, which is easy to do out in the burbs. When you get in town, there is no backyard, really.
Right. Well, and the community space in point four could be orchard and gardens.
Could be park.
Yeah, that's a nice idea.
Real farming.
Heaven.
Or maybe a tent up.
That's an interesting thing, what you mean by community space in one zone could be quite different than what it is in another zone.
Yeah, and it seems like you'll need to sort of lay that out a bit.
Are you considering in these dense zones the roadway to be a community space? Is that in your calculation?
If it met certain standards as a donor and was highly designed, absolutely.
Right.
But it can't just be asphalt parking lot.
But I don't think it should. I would say it wouldn't be the only community space. It should have. It can have. It certainly can have. Contribute to some of it. I think that if you look at a 10-lot R1 subdivision, instead of everyone having a lawn big enough to kick a ball around on, have much smaller lawns, and you have a green space in the middle where the kids can go kick a ball around. So it becomes a community park. So you're not having to spread everything out over, take more trees down in the process. So.
And how do you envisage that those neighbors sort of cooperate on that space, like who mows it and stuff? Is that something that goes into CC&Rs?
Yeah, there's HOAs virtually in every project we touch.
Okay. Yeah.
Less so as you get in the really less dense zones.
Sure.
You have more flexibility.
So my example of that would be the homes off of Cullendale, off of Weaver.
Yeah.
If they got that nice entry and they have that nice little area, it may not even be used a lot, but people look out on it. And it becomes their space by extension.
Yeah. No, we know people who live there. They use it for playing. My kids have been over to play out there. So.
Yeah, I think your point that you just said, I can't even restate it, about open space becomes less important as you get farther out and more important. I think that should be really
clear.
Very clear. That should be stated up front. I think that's an important.
And you see it in the numbers here on this chart. It's a smaller percentage in the less dense areas.
Right.
And then I guess another factor that I know you've been wrestling with would be where you get into the guidelines. Well, obviously, and again, this goes back to a cottage housing code. There's a lot of fundamentals in there that are transferable to some of these ideas, is that you'll see a certain number of homes have to front onto a community space. You can't put it down at the end of the street. Just a lot of these design patterns. And we want to be careful that we aren't overly prescriptive. We're not trying to have a cookbook for what we want this place to look like, but there are these principles that you want to see employed.
Can I, maybe go out of protocol here, but just going back to Madison, to the project on Madison we were talking about earlier that we didn't approve, they put the community center, it's basically a square, and they put the community area in the corner.
That's what I heard.
In the back.
In the back.
In the back, yeah.
In the corner. And how do we get that from a design review thing? We can recommend, and how do we get that someplace else? You know, and we made recommendations to them to move it, that they left it there.
Yeah. I mean, you look at this
yeah.
subdivision.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
they were forced to save those trees.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
walked by there yesterday. It's like, I'm not sure you can actually get into that area where the trees are. There's fences around the whole thing.
Well, you'll start to see, just to bounce around a little bit, a couple of other principles. We know what was here before the ponds went in, and this process allowed the ponds to replace a natural area. Well, under these new rules, a feature like this can't be considered natural space or community space. It has to live in that fluffy gray zone. If you want to go that route, then you've got a smaller pot, and you got to really want a pond and give something up to get it.
Mm-hmm. But and even in what you've written, Charlie, is that it's in this version is that those have to be sort of more structured natural spaces that deal with water. They're not a pond. They have to.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
have to be
design standards.
They yes. have to. They have. They can't just be a hole in the ground. They have to
with
have be multifunctional.
Right. Sure.
They have to. They can have standing water and they can have landscape in it. I mean, I was in Gainesville and saw an incredible wetland that was built out of nothing, and it's a beautiful amenity to the campus there. And there's ways to do it.
So it. It actually could be community space, potentially the same way a Vooner could be, mm-hmm. but we have to have, you have to demonstrate you're
yeah.
going above and beyond to get that benefit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And potentially it could become natural space if it was creating a
yeah.
whole new wetland that or something that was it also handling the stormwater, so.
And then another thing, because this is such a great example, because it's all in our minds, what we like and don't like. Another thing that we've been thinking about is how do buildings meet the street? And I'm not just going to look at this project, but you can look at countless subdivisions that the backs of homes face public ways, and there's a fence, and it's just a buzz killer. I mean, you walk around, and it's just you're just there with the cars, and that's your whole experience. So one of the things we want address to the guidelines is what are these more positive edges along public right-of-ways?
Right.
Can a home turn its back to the street? Maybe, but certainly not encouraged. Facing the street, the best, but maybe, you know, not the best for that busy street. Can you do a fence? Well, maybe you can. If so, what kind of fence? And then you also talked about this idea of natural edges. You want to do a 6-foot tall fence and turn your back, then maybe we prescribe a 50-foot or 25-foot fully planted buffer. So that's a better experience.
Yeah, because I think that's, as you look around right now, that's what's happening is we've got a proliferation of 6-foot high privacy fences.
Right
yeah.
along
yeah.
the sidewalk.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, you know, going down Wyatt, just sort of look around.
Yeah.
It's just.
Well, same
hideous.
With High School Road.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But there are, on Wyatt, there are some great examples of vegetated edges.
Yes,
at
exactly.
Cosgrove and down where Charlie lives. It's you've got to give it time, but you have to have the trees bonded and no fence between them and the roads.
Yeah, you know, one of those things about give it time, how long? You know, everybody plants the smallest, skinniest trees that the tree ordinance will let them get away with. And, you know, you have to wait a long time before a neighborhood starts to look nice.
Yeah. I think they come back relatively quick. But so as we look at these guidelines, this is largely how we went about writing them, is to think about what looks crappy
yep.
and what do we need in there so you guys have more teeth to police it.
Exactly.
And not police it, to help the applicant early on understand
what's the expectation?
Yeah, it's not like we're just going to whack you with a hammer at the end, because that never really
it doesn't work.
You're just beating up on something that's already bad to begin with.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they need a hammer to get to that. If they don't have a hammer at the end where they can say no.
No.
Then you're going to have applicants
right.
who come in and they just sort of go through the process, and then they already have in their mind what they want to do.
Yeah.
Well, if they don't meet your approval every step of the way and they come back with something else, then you should be able to say no, and Planning Commission should be able to say no, and they've been with force and mean it. and they've got to come back. So, and it becomes educational that this is the way you can do things. The standard way, business as usual, is not going to happen here. You've got to there, and there are great examples of creative solutions on the island and around the country and around the world. Mm. And so you've got to just kind of be aware of that.
Ron, my hope, sorry, is by forcing people to talk about these things at the conceptual design meeting, there's ownership and engagement. I mean, not everybody's going to understand these concepts, but you've got to engage with them.
Yeah.
Are you going to have a large presentation on this to... Do you have to present to people besides the city council, I guess?
Planning commission this week, and then we'll come... Well, Christy knows.
We've got a public meeting next week.
A public one. So when you do your public meeting, I think it's very important to get compelling images of built projects that, you know, you guys have actually participated in or know of that just tell you exactly what the experience will be like in a, just one
image. The good and the bad.
What's the one in that you sent? What was the one in LA that you sent the map?
Village Green.
Something Village Green.
Yeah, that was a good one.
No, but I mean, it's definitely, it's a very large project. But there are many examples, even on, like you were saying, just on the island.
So in terms of the process of an applicant coming before design review board or planning commission, if we were to use your checklist here, I am trying to imagine the process where we start off with A, and then in 1 through 5, we have to decide which of those you actually have to get a. What I'm looking for is when you look down this list, out of the first 5, does the applicant have to get 5 checks?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Under the site design, does the applicant have to get 10 checks?
Yes, yeah.
Because it seems like some of the next checks under site design go sort of a little bit either or. If you do this, maybe you don't have to do that.
But you still have to get a check.
Right, but I'm talking about getting a check in every box. I'm talking about...
Local food.
That's an example.
Well, okay, so you're here making a presentation and we're going to go through A. I want to have a box where I go 1, yes.
And I'm going to say I've 2, got 45% natural area. And I'm going to say, I've got special trees? No, I don't. Here's my survey. You go, okay, great. Checked.
All right, but then when we get down to the site design, we've got cluster home sites, neighborhood clusters. Okay, so are they both 8, and they're 8A and 8B?
No, they're two different ideas.
That's why I'm separating them into...
You
wouldn't be ticking both of them.
Yes, you would.
Yeah.
And I'll explain why. But one thing I just want to make clear, when you get to the guidelines, just the way your guidelines work now, I think there's an intent statement and then there's the requirements.
Yeah.
We didn't flesh that out on this. It's just too much verbiage. So that, it won't be this sparse. And the idea behind those two, A and B, Alan... the home site, two ideas with home sites. One is just do they meet the basic definition of the separation, whatever that criteria becomes, and you'd say yes or no. And then the other principle, if you think it's a good one, and this applies to cottage communities, is you can't have more than 10 cottages in a community. There's sort of this boundary where it doesn't function as a neighborhood unit any longer. So we may want to have a limit that you don't have 40 homes in a cluster. We may only want 8 to 10, and then you have to, boom, split over and do another one.
You have 3 clusters.
And I don't know that we want to do that, but we're just putting these out there as site planning principles to see if you think they're meaningful. But that's the difference, Alan.
Okay, what I'm looking for is if we're going to have a hammer, okay, we've got to be able to tell the applicant, sorry, you did not get a check in this box, down comes the hammer.
Agreed, but I think...
It seems like the city is going to want that to be very clear and very strict as to why the hammer came down on this and not...
Yeah, but I think it's possible to get a check in a box and not do it. I think what we see happening here is that you're going to create a narrative that's going to describe the process, the thinking behind the project. And we're going to come into you and say, now here's your checklist. Well, in this case, I'm doing this, but I'm not doing this because I'm doing this here. And you go, okay, you've satisfied me that you don't need to do that one because you've done something else instead. So we want people to really be thoughtful about it, to give you an answer for every piece that allows you to say they've satisfied the intent of the overall thing, and by not doing that, it's not killing the project. We're okay with it. We'll check it. And it said, met by exception.
Okay, maybe I'm being too persnickety here. I'd rather go with not applicable than putting a check against something that really isn't.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Do you follow what I mean?
Okay,
it's very clear that the checks become something that everyone can go back to later.
Well, it's this list. You just want someone, you want the client or the developer to have thought about all these things and resolved how they would approach it one way or the other.
Yeah.
Right.
So, anyhow, I agree.
I think you can check it and say NA, and so you can see a full list of checks, and it's satisfied. And if you've got an X in it, then, you know, they've made their home sites too far apart. You go, doesn't work, go redo it. Whatever it be.
Can I ask a question about number 13? B13. Facing public ways, limited fencing, home orientation. I understand exactly what you're saying there. How does that work when you're talking about clustering where you may be away from the public, the road versus a walkway?
Then it's not applicable.
Then it's not applicable.
Okay, you say we've got a 50-foot, our natural area happens to be along the main right-of-way. We're preserving that. It's not applicable. It's that way. But in some cases, maybe more urban, you say, well, actually, it's better for us for these on this street because it's a more appropriate street to reinforce that edge. Much like we did at Grove Phase 1, the houses on Grove face the street.
But why limited fencing? This seems to fly in the face of pet ownership, having children. How do you...
So it's limited by the fact that it's a 3-foot-high fence or 3-foot-6-high fence that's not solid, but it's continuous. It's not a 6-foot-high fence. You're limited by not being able to do a 6-foot-high fence that's solid on the edge.
And I think I disagree. I mean, this is what's fun about doing this.
Okay.
A little healthy dialogue. So what I would say is if you're one of those homeowners that wants the 6-foot fence or a developer, then maybe the prescription is you do a natural edge and you create a buffer so that the fence is set back a minimum 15 feet from the side.
Okay, I'm talking about different fencing. I'm talking about the fact that I need to keep in my own yard.
I understand that.
Yeah.
My...
That's the same type I'm talking about.
My chickens, my...
Solid board fence.
Can be a split rail fence with...
hog wire.
Chicken wire on the back of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kept the neighbor's dogs out of our yard.
The
public ways, the roads.
But we're not saying no fence, just limited type of fences. You can't put anything you want up there. If you need a fence to secure the kids,
it's here.
You do an open fence that's not 6 foot high, or if you're going to do a 6 foot high fence, it's set back enough you can have some good vegetation in front of it.
Not here. I don't think anybody's ever going to put a fence here. We certainly won't.
But we'll
make that clear.
That may need to be more, as you flush these through in the future, we want to say that maybe.
It's mainly just do we agree that seeing a 6-foot-tall yes. fence as you walk along a sidewalk isn't a desirable
it's
path?
It's not a walkable fence.
Okay,
it's
that's
not
what
a walkable
we're trying
fence.
To do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, even if this project had done the same thing as the next one down the street, where the landscaping was on the street side of the fence,
yeah.
as opposed
mm-hmm.
to not.
Yeah. Because the landscaping's there in this one, it's just on the other side of the fence.
Right, it's on the wrong side.
I want to reiterate, I'm a 3'6" person.
Fence person.
There's no way that you should ever have a 6-foot fence along the right of way for any reason. So that's my feeling.
I would agree.
Yeah. I would just like to say, I know you're not really done but to this, the presentation maybe, but I just feel like the whole theory to this is really good.
It moves forward
and it feels really good and you can tie it back. It's not just pulled out of the air. You know what I mean? That it's well grounded in thought, and I appreciate it.
Well, one of your comments originally was that it both creating this environment, the kinds of guys who do commodity development just will pass. Because this we can't do this, we don't know how.
Yeah.
See you later, goodbye. We'll go somewhere
else.
Which is kind of what we want them to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I mean,
we have to be careful
that if
someone doesn't perceive it as taking in some fashion, because we're forcing them into stuff. But I'm all for it.
The idea of the traditional setbacks gone. We're not talking about them anymore.
Well, we basically want to allow...
In terms of the traditional...
Yeah, I mean, we're property lot. Someone could build to a zero setback. Zero lot line houses. And what we're trying to build in all of this is the flexibility, so that all of those things that limit and don't, and that force you into a certain pattern that's not necessarily a good pattern, go away.
Right.
And it's all... And that's kind of where... The section about changes is on the development and dimensional standards, talking about changing those on the last page. You know whether it's lot coverage or lot size or zero lot line, all those things need to be changed in the code so that it's allowed. That gives people the opportunity to be creative about what they're doing.
I'd like to talk a little bit about, because I see some issues with this, and I'm going to do an example that I've used many times over the years. It's Thanksgiving. The weather's not great, and my mother-in-law is bringing her hot dish to Thanksgiving dinner, but we have clustered parking, which is away from the house. And
you send your teenager out.
Yeah, she texts. She texts when she gets there.
She's also wearing inappropriate shoes.
Why did she move
that? Yeah, I think that's part of it too.
The issue of minimizing roadways, minimizing driveways, and clustered parking. You know, those, yes, all work in this design idea in the practicality of living and family life. They don't necessarily work.
They're not for everyone.
So they're not for everyone.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned about legislating something where there needs to be some flexibility.
So this is where we have to be careful. We need your advice. We're not legislating this, and it looks like we are. If we think that it's a desirable outcome that we want to ask people, did you consider this? This may be one that needs to be thought differently as a guideline, because you're correct. It isn't a requirement.
It's a big issue.
But we don't want to preclude it. We don't want to leave it as something that isn't discussed. But you're right, Ellen. It's not a requirement.
I just read a statistic recently that 5-1 the car prowl crimes are they're 5 times greater when people are parked on the street or not in someone's driveway or their own parking space. And so, and the same thing applies to sort of cluster parking. And so I know everyone thinks of this as a very safe place, but in the future, that is, you know, problematic. Those are the cars that are away from the house, that are parked away from the house, that are the ones that are broken into. 5 times more than the ones that are parked in someone's driveway.
Okay. Well,
so it's just a crime consideration, safety, life and safety consideration.
Okay. Yeah. But if you're having a party here, and you've got your garage full of crap, because that's usually what happens with these, and you've got your 2 cars in the driveway, and you're having a party, and grandma comes, and you haven't saved her space in the driveway, she's going to have to park and walk down the street in the snow with her hot dish.
Oh, I know.
So it's not unique to clustered parking. It's unique to living. Unless you live in an underparked multifamily building, then you have that issue in life. So I think it's something that some people will choose not to live in a community like that, but there are plenty of other people who will. And we're not trying to preclude one way of doing it to another. It's like we do want people to reduce the impact of cars, but by clustering parking, that's not the only way to do it. So we want that the ability to cluster, the ability to remove the car from the house. But if someone wants to do a subdivision with parking in front of their on the house site, you know, like this, here's a diagram of an R1 10-unit community where I've shown 5 of the home sites have a driveway going to them. 5 of them don't. They could all have a driveway going.
You're saying you want the ability, and currently you don't have that ability. Exactly. Every house has to have a driveway and parking.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah. Unless you do HDP.
Yeah.
I also don't think, you know, this being worried about legislation, maybe I'm a social engineer, so maybe that's the problem, but I mean, I don't think we're legislating anything if there are other subdivisions where there are choices. I mean, certain people will live in certain places. Some people don't want to live downtown Winslow at all. They really want to be at the North End.
Yes.
I think when they come into town, they're doing it for trade-off, for reasons that they have convenience or this or that or the other thing. And they'll take, you know, I think they make those decisions themselves. I don't feel like we're legislating.
But aren't you leaving those sort of options open at all?
They're still open. Yeah,
yeah, they're still open.
Yeah.
But they're just going to look different. Uh-huh. And I think, as we've said probably in every meeting, is that we're still going to get some bad-looking projects. Yeah. It's just you can't,
so
can't get 100% certainty that they're going to turn out.
You've done such a good job here. You've given us something to pick at. So
that's great. Really good job. That's why we're here.
So let us pick. So 23. Housing diversity, a range of home sizes. It is more than likely that a developer who is coming in with a subdivision has got a product that they want to build, and that product is unlikely to be a diverse number of housing sizes.
So trying to keep those guys out.
I'm sorry?
We're trying to keep those guys
exactly
out.
Exactly, we are.
This is the fact of
life.
Of life. This is how the majority of developers make the most money. Here's the plan. They're going to build these. Now,
If it's
going to say housing diversity, it almost seems like it needs to be more clearly defined.
Can I speak to that?
Absolutely.
So, and this is one approach. I'm not sure it's the best one, but let's say
the average builder wants to build a 2,000 square foot house. That's probably way smaller than what they, might be what we want them to build. But the concept might be, Alan, behind housing diversity is that, what did we come up with? Either 20 or 40% of the houses
40%
have to deviate in size, some percentage, and it has to be fairly round numbers. So the idea would be is if this is your average, let's say it's 20% have to vary, you'd have to scale down by a minimum increment, let's say 400 square feet or 600 to get to that smaller
house.
Are you
talking about total square footage?
Total square footage. And then correspondingly, you can deviate to the flip side and go to the bigger footprint so that we're not cheating them on square footage, but we're forcing variation in home size. And we're forcing kind of different massing as well.
But this is where you're doing social engineering.
I think we're trying to get a variety of house designs rather than a cookie-cutter approach.
But does it have to be in one development on one piece of property? Or is it different pieces of property in different zones?
I would argue, I think we want variety within a single community.
Yeah. Would it be greater than X units or something?
Yeah,
you
do
like
potentially. Yeah.
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 Okay.
And so this, what we list here and we had on our chart at some point was the idea of a maximum average house size that varies through the zones, gets smaller as you get into the high density, mm-hmm. and so that you know coming into it, okay, I've got to hit an average of 2,000. I have this, but I want to build some 3,000 square foot houses. Maybe you could build three of those if you built 3,000 square foot houses. And so it gives the opportunity for flexibility for the builder that they can have bigger houses if they want it,
mm-hmm.
but it gets the diversity they want, which comes back to market affordability, a range of housing types at a range of prices that a range of different types of people could afford to buy.
John? Isn't it wise to plan for ADUs?
Yeah, this doesn't preclude ADUs.
No, it doesn't preclude, but I think we can count on them
in the future.
As an option in the future.
Yeah.
No.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's... I don't know what the track record is of people doing them after the fact. And secondly, most developers don't build them on the front end because it just makes the purchase price that much higher.
Well, the project in Linwood Center is kind of a lesson because the ADUs went first. That's where
they actually used the ADU thing to create some diversity.
Right. Yes.
So they got diversity that way. And they were able to, with the condominiumizing of them, able to sell those, and the smaller ones were the cheaper ones, and therefore more attractive to people. Mm-hmm. So that you know, there's the case that actually this type of diversity is necessary. So.
And they were sold, as everyone knows, they were sold separately.
Yeah.
But that's not an ADU.
Yeah.
It's a small house.
Yeah, it's a condominium.
Yeah. Correct.
Well, this is slightly different than ADUs, because theoretically on this property, this site plan here, you could get 10 ADUs
mm-hmm.
if planned for. Now, the interesting thing when you start to have clustered parking and so forth, and you want to build an ADU after the fact, where are you going to park? So there's, which new thing to think about.
Interesting design, though.
Yeah.
So why do you have a maximum square footage? I can understand having minimums, but why would you have a maximum?
For a house?
Yeah. I think you said that you were going to have it.
But that's what we're talking about, an average. Well, we talked about
it. I like the average better than a maximum.
Well, it would be a maximum average.
Yeah.
So that, I guess if we're thinking about sustainability, reducing our impact on the environment, and so all of that stuff, one way to do all the Jason would tell you about, all the sustainability guys talk about, is reducing your building size reduces your footprint,
which mm-hmm. Jason did.
Which Jason is totally.
No, not that Jason.
Oh,
the other Jason.
I agree. I think of him as a very good example. That.
Yeah.
So anyhow,
I don't know who the Jason is.
does anybody have a problem with making a maximum
storage
house?
Okay.
I mean, we have it right now, and we have it right now in the HDDP.
What the maximum?
Maximum 1,600 square foot net.
Yeah, I don't like HDDP. I don't like those parts of it.
Because we haven't seen a good one. That's why.
Everybody likes to be in that, so let's skip that topic for now.
So I'm wondering why you would have no maximum, but you do have, like, I can understand a minimum, and traditionally we had minimum sizes for things. But if you have, does it just apply across?
We don't have to have a maximum home size.
Okay.
I think what is important is that
the average or something
is that the home site is thought about as the footprint, you know, the relative area of impact.
Right.
And then the other thing we want to be careful about is that we don't end up with, again, like Ashbury, where the scale relationship of these homes, they should have just been row houses, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly.
So we definitely, and this gets back to the setback issue, I think we need better standards about what setbacks mean relative to the scale of the adjacent uses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Jonathan and I have talked about this, the bigger buildings get, probably the farther apart they should be, and that's going to reduce the density. So it's like a governor on an engine. You know, if people want an efficient site plan, they may rethink their square footage a little bit. Do you see what I'm getting at? So you don't end up with a 6 foot wide gap.
I understand what you're getting at, but I don't know if that's what I'm reading here. I understand having X square feet for a certain area, and within that, different sizes of houses or dwelling units. That's quite sensible.
I think this maximum home site size will be really controversial.
Yes,
and why get ourselves beat up over something if it isn't accomplishing a whole lot? I mean, we're put it out there because we're not sure if it's a good idea or not.
Yeah.
And we need your help whether it is or isn't. But if we don't do that, we definitely have to have this limited home site size that doesn't allow, you know, that regulates the growth. And if we can have, you know, building separation, if you were doing a big house, you either put it right next to another house, touching it, or you have to spread it apart so that you can breathe.
Yeah.
And as you get into town and things get more dense, then that becomes narrower and narrower.
Words are important to me somehow, but we've redefined subdivision here. Really, what we've done, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why are we going to continue to call it a subdivision?
Here's the microphone. when I got up and stood up in opposition to the moratorium, the solution is throw out the term subdivision. And there's some question whether we can actually do that from the state RCW point of view. But Christy thinks we probably can. John wonders if we can't. But I would love to throw out the term, and we've, you know, call them conservation communities or just communities or whatever it is, but some other word. We, as a balance right now, because we're not sure, we're calling them subdivision communities, but I think they are no longer subdivisions in the traditional sense.
You have residential zones here, which is one.
Could I ask a question relative to that?
Yeah.
Christy, when the applicant is coming in with their subdivision, they don't necessarily have to show what housing type. They're showing lots or the breakup of the land. So you could go down this list and you could say, in terms of the subdivision of a piece of property, do they even have to tell you this information right up front? Do they even know this information right up front? I mean, when you
usually do know it for a couple of reasons. One is the commodity standpoint, and the other is all their infrastructure.
Yeah, stormwater.
Stormwater particularly. They have to know how much hard surface they have. So they have a general sense of how much of that they have. terms of whether legally that they have to per subdivision law, I can ask that question.
I think it would be good to know whether they actually have to show the size of the house. I mean, yes, you can provide services to a lot, but what is going to be built on that lot could change in 6 months or 12 months, depending on the economy. You're still going to want water and electricity. Right.
We have a, currently in our subdivision standards, they refer to this table, which is not in our subdivision standards. So this is subdivision standards that in and of themselves are in 1712, and this is in 1812, the dimensional standards that apply to subdivisions. And they have lot coverage, so in a sense, we don't tell them where it has to go, but we do tell them the maximum size they can have of lot coverage, which is good.
But it seems like a lot of this is telling them where it can go. I mean, a lot of the new list.
And, I mean, one of the things I appreciate about HDDP is that when you come in to do an HDDP subdivision, you have to show you guys what it's going to look like. And I, in my thinking on all of this, they go hand in hand. That someone coming in to do a subdivision has to come in and show you this is what it's going to be, at least from a schematic point of view, and this is where the homes are going to sit. And again, it's trying to get away from the commodification of the land, and that it's that we're creating communities, not land exchanges.
So it would bring design into the issue right off the bat.
Exactly.
But right now, design actually is almost the last thing that goes into a subdivision.
That's what I meant about now we're trying to invert the process.
I think it's very important.
Yeah.
But then, a lot of these developers hate mankind, but a lot of them will just bring a civil in and say we're doing a subdivision.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the problem. I mean, if they know coming in, they're not doing a subdivision in the traditional LA suburbs kind of thinking.
That's why the city brings in engineers. I mean, isn't it true that first the city will have the engineers look at it, the subdivision?
Fassar?
No.
Well,
they look at it at the same time at the.
I feel they have
the pre-app or the preliminary.
Yeah. I feel they have more impact than they should. So.
Can I, recognizing the time,
so got three
yeah.
And, yeah. I, and also recognizing the questions you had at the very beginning about the dimensional standards mm-hmm. and about the pieces not adding up to 100, I think that's something that we, it'd be nice to just talk about how much flexibility do we want to build into these percentages, and what we've got here, what we're calling minimum natural space, minimum community space, and then maximum home site, and we see that this doesn't add up to 100%, and we see that the natural space doesn't meet the ARPA requirement of 65%, though ARPA has, you know, ARPA does allow you to reduce it if you have a hydrological study and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so how important is it to have flexibility, or should we divide? We have another version of this chart that shows 100, this adding up to 100%, and it makes you, could make you build certain percentages of each thing. And so, now here, this is a diagram that uses R1, and this one actually has 65% natural space, ARPA space, and it's got 10% community space, 10% of its lots, and then the rest is sort of infrastructure space. This is a version of it where it's got 45% natural space as the per the chart. It's got, no, excuse me, 10%, you have 10% community space and 10% lot space. And it's got all this stuff that's left. And what do we allow, what do we feel about that spacing, allowing some flexibility? Now, if they can't show that they can reduce ARPA, then it's going to go back to ARPA. If they come in and want to do a hydrological study and meet the ARPA requirement, what can they do in that space?
Jonathan, can I just clarify that here you say lot?
Well, I mean,
You mean home site?
I mean, they're labeled as home sites. I copied and pasted from somewhere, so it's home sites.
Okay, but then my understanding of home site is more of a something within a lot?
Yes. Yeah, so, right? So the lot might, I mean, the lot might come and do this. You know, it could do, you know, or it comes out this way. So the lot, again, because, as Charlie sort of talked about at the beginning, you figure out how you want to lay this out, and you lay it out the way you want, and then you configure the lots to give you, you know,
the only person that cares about lots is the health department, honestly.
Well, and the, I mean, the development community, we, with Ray Stevens was in, and he the idea of making a 4,000 square foot lot didn't make a lot of sense to him, because he felt that it devalued the project. I kind of disagree with him, but by by calling them home sites and allowing a lot to be something bigger than the home site, you can manage the septic issue with the health department. We want to allow septic to go not on site into community areas, if that's appropriate. But it's a, you know, if someone's buying, wants to buy a basically an acre of land on a 10-acre development, because they feel that that gives them value, and maybe that's how the appraisers evaluate it, is do we can still do a project like this, and then you do lots, and then you create easements over the top of them for the community space and industry.
But there still has to be ownership of all the rest of the land.
Yes.
There still has to be responsibility for the roadway, the driveways, the parking. So there is some other kind of legal home ownership structure
There's an open
which
space
applies to the total piece of property which is under a subdivision.
Are there setbacks shown in there at all?
No. Okay. No, this is, we haven't.
Okay.
I mean, this is, if you remember those pipe diagrams I did the other day, this is one step beyond that where we're starting.
Okay.
Well, I'm just thinking of our best interest when you present it so it's so graphically clear what the hell's going on. You only need two or three of these.
And the thing that we're wrestling with is what I was just saying to Jonathan today. I think when we draw these examples, ideally we have good-looking examples of this, you know, the different densities. This is so abstract, and people tend to take it very literally as an image, and I think we want to show it in a more evocative sense, because we want all of these to look good if this is the rule book.
Exactly.
But these aren't representing, those aren't home sites that are 40,000 square feet each.
No, they're home sites that are 4,000 square feet each, which is what we have as the requirement in R1.
R1.
Right. Well, I'm just... It says home sites, 40,000 square feet.
That's the total area of the 10 home sites, right. Is 40,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. So those two pink area or beige areas are 40,000 square feet of the overall lot.
So just to get back to the question Jonathan was asking, I think at this point, and I know we're going to play with these numbers some more, it's just we haven't had the chance. These are the kind of discussions that help shape them, but we'll have a minimum requirement or percentage for natural, for open space, probably some restrictions on home site sizes. And I think our goal right now is not to drive, we can't drive that all the way up to 100%. And it seems like if people meet those threshold requirements, then the balance of the site, they have flexibility to explore and fit it to different site constraints. I mean, every site's going to be different. Some are going to have more roads, some are going to have less. I don't think just because you have more white space you should have to do more natural space, unless, again, it's a requirement either of ARPA or it's the motivation of that property owner. So these are the things we're wrestling with still, to lay these qualities over the whole, all the different zones.
Just a big picture question about subdivisions. Is there some number of potential subdivisions on Bainbridge?
We're hoping. Oh,
I'm starting to work on it. So, this is just our 04, 1, and 2, these are subdividable properties. Mm-hmm. So there's multiple hundreds.
Multiple hundreds.
Yeah, but most of them you'll see is this 3 to 4 lot subdivision. The darker ones are the 10 plus lots. So there are some of those. But you'll see also that a lot of the subdividable properties are along the shoreline, so the likelihood of them subdividing is lower, definitely.
At least on the small one.
Yeah.
Right. So of the 10 lots, how many of those are there, did you think?
Oh, probably at least a dozen. Yeah.
And so is this what we're talking about, a potential of a dozen?
So we're trying out there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, too, that I need to do is you could take 2 of the 5 to 9, you know, like DeNova's done successfully in their model, and have contiguous parcels and do some, take 4 properties and turn it into 19 lots.
Right. Yeah, great.
The aggregating of the lots. So my next step is a scrub of this to pick those up as well, and then to try to do some level of analysis. If there's a $1 million assessed value home on the shoreline, they're probably not going to subdivide.
Right, so but I mean, if you scrub those through a SAR filter as well, wouldn't you be able to sort of come up with a certain amount of knowledge about the trees, the natural, but of these remaining ones, and even tailor this a little more specifically? Is that ridiculous?
I mean, the percent cover in the zoning designation of the land cover is about 72% tree. So we already know that the majority of these parcels exceed ARPA, actually.
Right.
So,
because, I mean, if we're going to get down to some number less than 50, it would seem that we could get relatively specific about some of these sites in the sense of, hey, you can do this, this, or this, or you can do on this one, or you can do that, that, or that. I mean, they're going to be driven to that extent, aren't they?
That's a lot easier in the more dense zones, actually. And I've done these numbers, too. They're just not on this map, and there are many fewer. So we can really look at, you know, there's like 3 R5 lots that are left.
Right.
So we can really say, what do we want to do in R5?
Yeah.
So, Christy, don't underestimate the large waterfront lots. I just heard this weekend of a $3.5 million piece of property on Lake Washington, admittedly. That had a historic house on it that was purchased, a house taken down, the land subdivided. So
yeah, the age of the structure is something else I have to consider.
Yeah, so we're looking out into the future here. You know, this isn't going to be redone, so
I'm not discounting it. Excuse me, I'm just saying the likelihood in our planning horizon.
Yeah.
Trying to get a better sense of that.
Because Venice Beach, California, 60-foot lots, 60 by 60. $3 million, $4 million now, if they're on the Venice canals.
Yeah.
So you can see why you could take a big waterfront lot and manage to do, you know, $2 million dwellings on those.
Yeah.
It's coming right up.
So are we on the right track, or does somebody see any big flaws?
I think people are going to zoom to whatever you give them on this one. And to the graphics, you know, the bulk of the people you're going to have to jump to. I think it's very difficult to leave so much of the land unresolved here. Not adding up to 100%. I mean, what are the things that wouldn't fit into any of these categories?
Roadways, some of the LID features potentially. What else?
Yeah.
Well, shouldn't I just be there to help get to that?
We'll put them back in.
I think this is the, at the moment, this is the weakest part.
Yeah,
Jim, you've seen
the
hardest
part to understand.
It's the hardest part to figure out.
I see somebody
The color codes need a bit more explanation, too.
Okay, yeah.
But I think I'm very good about clarity. Like, simple things, I understand
clarity.
And one of the issues I have with this one is it seems like the bigger properties are being given too much in terms of the home site size. You know, so that 10%.
Well, that number, the 10%, the 10,000 square feet, came from when we were calling them lots. So I think you're right, because mm-hmm. then we felt that on a bigger piece property, if we were doing maximum mm-hmm. lot sizes, they had to have some substantial nature to them, more estate. Mm-hmm. But so for a house, a home site on an R4.4 should be smaller than 10,000.
Yeah.
And the other thing we may be able to do is actually create home site coverage, for example. I mean, there may be,
I think that would be
limitations
very
within a home site.
I agree.
So you have to explain this.
Lot coverage or home site coverage, I think, is something that a developer relates to. It's common language.
Yeah.
The other idea about a home site was that when you go out there and start building, you put a fence around that home site. And I mean, if you were aggregating three of them, kind of like that, mm-hmm. then you would put a fence around the overall, or it would be, I mean, you put fences up around the areas you didn't want people touching. It would be very defined.
I think the other piece of this, which again is the hard thing to understand about the ownership, the future ownership structure, mm-hmm. is the potential for common access to all of the leftover land.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how it's divided up, but when I'm buying this home site, I'm actually getting access to walk over this whole, mm-hmm. however big a part of it.
That's very standard language in it.
So something on here which somehow refers to common access land, as opposed to natural space or community space.
What about a realtor's perspective on how this looks for the market as they understand it, as we move beyond the perspective of how designers design it and cities plan it, so that we understand how does this satisfy a market? Because we're sort of creating these different kinds of saleable entities. Do they meet the market? Do realtors sit with you and say, hot dog, or hang on a minute, I'm going to have a really hard time selling that because it's not Leave It to Beaver. There's rich guys up here and people who've got 1,100 square footers down there. So I'm just wondering, have you really sat with realtors and so that they understand they're selling?
Do you think
it's worthwhile asking them?
I think intuitively we've got a pretty good feel, as most people in the room, what the status quo is. And, you know, I would think people wanting backyards is going to be important, and have we thought about that?
Yep.
You know, does the home site facilitate that? Being able to drive right up to your house, I bet 95% of the people you ask would want that. How many parking spaces should they be allowed to have at a house? I don't know. Probably people would want no limitation. I mean, I think an average home size is probably 2,800 square feet.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we know the answers to all those things.
Okay.
What people want. Between the two of them, they've had a lot of experience.
I'm just asking the question, that's all.
Yeah. But I think there are people that aren't served by the marketplace, because the marketplace tends to cater towards the biggest, highest dollar value.
Yeah. Exactly.
And we're not incentivizing other approaches to community.
Yeah, and so I think that's what I was wondering about this, in the sense of, you know, there's tons of people on this island who'd love to see tiny homes. How else do we, or the ADU proliferation, you know, for smaller dwellings, we've got to make sure that we enable that, because I get how this does, averaging, but, you know, how do we end up with people have 500 square foot dwellings in this set of plan, this structure that we're creating? Is there room for somebody to do that?
Yeah, good question.
Because there's market for it.
I know you need to go, but before he goes, I just wanted to bring up one point, because I think it's something Peter may have a comment on. B10, which is pedestrian connections, one of the things that we have stressed a lot is understanding how a piece of property fits within a bigger neighborhood. And the pedestrian connections, I feel like we need to be thinking about how does this lot connect to the next lot, connect to the next lot.
Exactly.
I mean, we've faced that a lot with some of the projects we've reviewed where sort of like they don't really take into account what's around it.
I
feel this is perhaps just a little weak to say off-site connections. It needs something more, and internal paths. It needs something that allows the city to think in a bigger way about continuing to build pedestrian networks.
And wildlife corridors as well, because you know they don't have a voice, all the little possums and squirrels. But
doesn't Charles? Aren't you quite active with this whole series of pathways and trails?
But I think those two go together. If it's a pathway for people, you've got to make sure there's a pathway for animals too.
Yeah. What I told you last time, this is coming up now.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. I might
Maybe
last
night. All right. The design review board meeting is currently adjourned because we no longer have a quorum.
I did actually